Welcome to the Growing EBITDA podcast, where we unlock the doors to management and technology insights in the middle market. Join us as we explore innovative strategies to drive revenue and EBITDA growth, interviewing industry leaders and technology experts. Whether you're looking to streamline operations, understand the latest tech trends, or lead your company towards exponential growth, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and let's grow together.
Hey, Mike, welcome back.
Back in action.
Back in action. Back at it. I thought today that we could take a little trip down memory lane from about 5 years ago when I joined Trivista. I remember you were pretty instrumental in helping me in what we're going to talk about today. To kind of set the tone for our listeners, I had come out of a publicly traded company and been in publicly traded companies for a while. And through a series of events, found Trivista, or Trivista found me and was able to join. And what we're going to talk about today...
Didn't you respond to an ad in a paper?
Correct.
Classifieds?
Yeah, I think it was Craigslist. But what we're going to talk about is an introduction to private equity. And I was familiar with M&A activities. I had been familiar with carve-outs, take privates, all that type of stuff, but hadn't really had the opportunity to really understand private equity to the depth 5 years later that I have now. But it was thanks to you kind of pushing my boat off the shore that I was able to learn some of those things. I thought it'd be good for you, Mike, to be able to share some of that with your listeners. But to maybe start it off, could you share a bit about how you got in private equity and how you kind of started on this journey?
Yeah, absolutely. So not dissimilar from you, my private equity origin story was I used to work at a large Fortune 300 business, diversified industrials, couldn't be further from the private equity sector. Candidly, I don't even think I had ever heard the words private equity. And maybe I had read about it in the Wall Street Journal or something like that. I wouldn't suggest that I understood what those two words meant at all at the time. This is, you know, going on 20 years ago now. And, you know, after a fairly short career in industry, I had the opportunity to start our firm with some of our other partners. And it just so happened that we decided to start a consulting business that would consult to the private equity industry. Now, fortunately, my partners knew a little bit more about private equity than I did. A little bit is probably an exaggeration. They could spell the words private equity. I'm still to this day wonder kind of how they found themselves understanding what it meant even to at a surface level. But that's a story for another time
on the podcast.
That would be a good interview to do. But that was the beginning of my journey. So it was via consulting was my first exposure to PE, short for private equity. And our business at the time, the kind of thesis for starting the company was that private equity investors who were out there acquiring businesses for us, businesses in the industrial space and industries that we were very well versed in from our industry backgrounds. They, you know, these private equity firms were out investing in these companies, and we were going to provide them with expertise, sector, you know, industry expertise, functional, operational expertise, and guidance as they did due diligence on some of those acquisitions. And then our thought was we could help some of those companies after they were acquired to grow and prosper and optimize operations, et cetera. So that was my first foray into the private equity ecosystem. So spent a good decade or so working in a lot of private equity backed businesses as an advisor or as a consultant, sold a lot of work to private equity firms, built a lot of relationships with private equity firms. I've probably personally visited 400 or 500, maybe more, different private equity firms around the world. Do a lot of work in Asia and Europe over the years, as well as a lot of work, obviously, in the United States and throughout North America. And to be honest, throughout those first 10 years or so, really started to take an interest beyond the companies that they were buying in industries that were interesting to us and relevant to our industry backgrounds, but really started to get interested and more involved in understanding how the private equity business model really worked. And I think at first it started from a place of pure curiosity. But also, I was trying to better understand my customers, right? And I felt like if I could better understand the investor's business model as a, you know, I wasn't a professional investor by training or by trade at that point. I was an operator of businesses and a consultant to businesses, operating companies. My thought was that if I much better understood the private equity business model and the investment theses and how the underwriting process for new deals took place and really, quite frankly, ramped up my financial acumen and my M&A acumen, that I could serve those private equity clients better. So I decided at one point, and I'm not sure if it was a conscious decision or what, but I started researching a lot more than I ever had on how the private equity ecosystem worked. We had done a little bit of co-investing into some of the deals that our private equity clients were acquiring. And that, I think that actually with hindsight was probably what piqued a lot of my curiosity too, because we had some successful investments and I wanted to do more of them. And I was just really curious as to how they worked. So spent probably 5 or 6 years going deep down some dark rabbit holes on online and listening to podcasts and reading books and attending some courses that I could find that were about the topic of how private equity works, how funds get raised, how deals get done, how terms of M&A transactions get negotiated, how deals get financed, you know, a lot of things that quite frankly were impacting all of the businesses that we were involved in. You know, our firm, as we started out, our consulting business exclusively advised private equity firms, not the case today. We advise a broad spectrum of clients, but in spite of the fact that I had worked in that sector for 10 years, I really didn't understand how the PE business model really had come together. So spent a long time researching it, and that's how I kind of stumbled into it.
Now, I think the great thing for our listeners today is kind of culminating all that into kind of a 101, as we discussed, and kind of taking our listeners through all that experience. You save them all that Googling, I guess the new way of saying it's all that GPTing, and they can kind of use that knowledge, a lifetime of knowledge for a 30-minute conversation. And maybe we can just jump in and kind of the 101 crash course.
Let's do it. Let's do it. So as we were preparing for this episode, I was trying to put myself in the shoes of the listener. So kind of beyond just recognizing there's a lot of folks out there who, like me 20 years ago, like you 5 years ago, really don't understand private equity, at least not to a level that they would like to. So just recognizing there's a lot of people out there that are in those shoes. So it's important to provide some relevant content to those folks. But also, I think we hear a lot about private equity in the media. You can't read a single national newspaper without reading about some private equity deal that's getting done in some industry or another, whether it's private equity firms trying to get involved in sports teams, private equity firms doing take privates of large publicly traded businesses, backing the next great consumer brand, fast growing consumer business. It's in the media, it's prolific, it's kind of omnipresent these days. The reason that that is not just because private equity firms have great PR departments. In fact, I think very few private equity firms even have PR departments. But the reason that that is that private equity is a bigger part of the U.S. economy than I think most people realize. And I pulled some stats. And to put that into perspective, and the stat that I have is from 2021. You could presume it's a little bit more than that today after a couple more years of economic growth. But in 2021 alone, private equity invested over $1 trillion in the American economy. $1 trillion. Currently, private equity firms manage about $3 trillion of capital that is committed to their funds, but has not yet been invested in businesses. $3 trillion. So it is a huge part of the U.S. economy. 2021, 5,200 businesses representing 74% of all of the investments that were made in businesses in the U.S. were private equity backed deals. And 97% of those deals were businesses in the middle market under revenue size of, let's just call it roughly about $500 million. So the number of 10, 20, 50, 100, 200, $500 million revenue businesses, these are sizable businesses, could employ hundreds or thousands of people across the country that have private equity as an investor is quite significant. Probably something like couple hundred thousand, maybe 300,000 or 400,000, 500,000 businesses in the U.S. that are backed by a private equity firm in some way, shape, or form. So a big part of the U.S. economy. And I think it's important that executives who are less familiar with their private equity ownership model, who are maybe working in a family-owned, large family-owned business, or maybe a publicly traded business or a division of a publicly traded business, if you've never been owned or backed by private equity investors before, and you're halfway through your career, it's highly likely that at some point you're going to be working with a private equity firm directly.
It's tough for us to think at that scale, right? That's that Apple Amazon scale of value. And I think those kind of make headlines when you think about the total. That's a larger number than I expected. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that you mentioned, putting on my 101 hat, is committed to their fund. Could we maybe, and maybe you're going to cover it a bit in the future, but just to kind of talk about what that commitment means, mm-hmm. and kind of parsing that out from deployed to committed.
So let's come back to commitment. And here's why. I want to start by talking about what private equity is and what private equity isn't. So I'm going to kind of go 100,000 foot level, and then we're going to get more into the nuances of the actual business model and some of the specifics. So first and foremost, private equity invests in typically mature operating businesses. So this is not venture capital. This is not early stage businesses. This is not angel investing. This is not $0 in revenue. We've got the next Facebook or Airbnb. As a result, while there certainly are private equity firms that exclusively invest in mature tech businesses, tech is a much more common place for venture capital firms or VC firms to play than it is for private equity firms. It involves investing in these mature operating businesses, being an investor in those companies for X number of years, could be 3, 4, 5, 7, 10. Some firms have longer strategies, up to 20 plus years, trying to grow those businesses to the next level of maturity and then exit or realize or sell those investments on to somebody else. It could be another private equity fund. It could be another corporation, maybe selling it to a publicly traded business, could be doing an IPO. So big difference between private equity and venture capital. Venture capital tends to be very early stage businesses, sometimes pre-revenue, like I mentioned, sometimes pre-product concepts, sometimes slightly more mature than that, but oftentimes, you know, very early stage businesses. Also, what private equity isn't is private equity is not a hedge fund, right? A lot of people think hedge funds, private equity, kind of same thing. Hedge funds typically are buying large stakes of publicly traded businesses using private capital that they've raised. So that element, the capital sources tend to be similar of the private equity fund to a venture capital fund, and as well as to a hedge fund. But the types of investments that they're making couldn't be more different. So private equity, think investing in private businesses that are mature to some degree or another. Venture capital, same thing. You're investing private capital, but into early stage businesses. Hedge funds, investing private capital, but investing into typically publicly traded businesses. So those are some of the key differences, but there are a number of similarities. It's not surprising that they're confusing to folks who aren't living in this world each and every day.
Yeah. My first business was actually VC backed. And I think as I learned more, I had that assumption that there was a lot of similarities in the two, and quickly learned that there are some vast differences on, and I think some of the things we're into, but around structure, mm-hmm. communication, what they're looking for. And I think that's a good distinction, because I think to me previously, I would have viewed them as more synonyms and kind of the way that the firm or brand kind of presented itself, but it's more than that.
So what it is a group of professionals will go out and they'll raise capital, right? So they're going to go out to any number of different type of investors. They could go out to some large wealthy families. They could go out to some university endowments, some pension funds, the same places that a venture capital firm is going to raise money from, the same place that a hedge fund, the same place that anybody in the world who's raising significant capital, who isn't going to the public markets to do so via some type of initial public offering or something similar. So this, you know, this group of professionals will start this private equity firm, and they will go out and raise a private equity fund. So big difference between those two things. The private equity firm is the brand. It's, you know, XYZ Investors would be the brand of the private equity fund. I'm sorry, the private equity firm. And they would go out and start raising their first private equity fund. They're going to go out to some of those investors that I mentioned, and they're going to go and try and raise X number of dollars. Let's just, for the purposes of this discussion, they're going to go out and raise $500 million. Right? Sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. There's more money in this world, certainly, than I ever realized. There's a lot of these private equity funds out there raising capital all the time. But they go out, they raise this capital, and they put it into what's referred to as a private equity fund. So you have many different investors all pooling their capital into one singular fund. And then that singular fund, managed by XYZ investor, private equity firm, is going to go out and start to make investments in these mature operating businesses. Different investment firms have different strategies. One might be focused on industrials. One might be industry agnostic. One might be focused on services businesses. There's a bunch of different strategies out there, geographic strategies, et cetera, as you might imagine. So they're going to take this private equity fund, this $500 million that they've raised, and they're going to go and try and make investments. Most of the time, in your kind of typical fund, they're going to make, let's say, somewhere between 8 to 10 investments. For example purposes, we're going to continue to use 10 because it'll allow us to do some easy math on the fly here. So they raise the $500 million. They go out and they make 10 investments. The size of their fund oftentimes will dictate the size of businesses that they're going to buy. Earlier when I described them buying mature businesses in what we would refer to as the middle market, a synonym for that would be medium-sized businesses. These are companies that typically have between 20 and 500, maybe 20 million and $1 billion in revenue, maybe up to about 2 to 3 billion is kind of the upper end. Somebody who's raised $500 million in a fund, they're probably going to go look to buy or invest in 10 companies doing somewhere between $100 to $150 million a year in revenue, right? So they're buying fairly medium-sized, you know, on the smaller end of kind of medium-sized businesses, and they're going to invest in those companies through a combination of the equity, which is the fund that they've raised, that $500 million. They're also going to go and probably raise some debt and put some debt on the balance sheet of those businesses as they acquire them or as they invest in them. They're going to try and grow those businesses over time, and they're going to try and sell them at some point in the future at a profit. There's a lot of commonalities. The simplest way I've ever come up with describing this is flipping a house, right? Private equity firms, they gather a bunch of money up. They go out and they look for quote unquote houses to buy. They're looking for ones that they think that they could reasonably improve over a reasonable period of time. And to the extent that they can be successful doing that, sell it to somebody else and make a profit. It's no more complex than that in its simplest form. Obviously, doing it is a lot harder though than this simple description would suggest. But that's the basic business model. And we can talk more about kind of how they do some of those things in a little bit more detail. But that's kind of the next level of granularity. For our listeners, who primarily is, as hopefully most of our listeners have come to appreciate, we primarily are speaking to kind of operating executives who are leading medium-sized organizations, who are executing M&A strategies, who are growing businesses, trying to grow EBITDA, a little pun intended there. I think it's really important for the reasons we described earlier that they understand these mechanics of the private equity industry because, like we talked about, oftentimes they're going to be coming across these private equity firms, whether they're working with them in some type of collaborative way or maybe you're selling a business to a private equity fund. It's important that you understand some of these dynamics.
So now I've got my pot of money for all intents and purposes. I'm worked really hard on getting that. I know kind of generally what my mantra is and what I want to do. Now I want to go and invest in a business. What do I do? What is that process? What does that look like? What are those kind of next steps I'm doing now that sure. I have my fund?
Yeah. So the private equity firm has raised their fund, you know, and they're going to go out and buy these 10 businesses. So how they start, let's just go with company number one. There are a number of sources that you can go to look for businesses for sale. This is not a podcast about all of those sources, right? But there's investment bankers, there's five different flavors of investment bankers, there's approaching companies directly. And these private equity investors get quite good at finding those sources for what they would call their deal flow. They're trying to look at a lot of deals. because they're trying to be selective. Even though they're trying to invest in 10 businesses, it's certainly not going to be the first 10 businesses that they stumble across. You may not, some of our listeners may not realize just how many they look at. To invest in 10 businesses, they're probably looking at somewhere between 500 to 1,000 businesses, if not over their fund's life cycle, you know, maybe even more than that. It could be 500 to 1,000 a year to try and invest in those 10 businesses. And by the way, I'd point out those 10 investments, they're typically making those over about a 5-year horizon. So this is not raise $500 million, invest $500 million. This is raise $500 million, and that might take them 1, 2, 3 years to raise the money. And after they've done that, they're going to go and start investing it, right? So a typical private equity fund life is about 10 years. So from the time that you commit to the fund, if you're an investor, you're involved in that for 10 years. There's really no out that's easy. So these are really kind of long-term investors for the investors in these groups. So the private equity funds raise the money. They're going out. They're looking for their deal flow. They're trying to do their first investment. They find, let's just say they find a business that they like. Let's use that example from before, $100 million revenue, industrial manufacturing business. So they found this business. They like it. It's in the right geography. It's serving some growing end markets. They think it's got a decent leadership team. It seems like it's got a sound strategy. It produces nice margins. And they negotiate a purchase price and a purchase structure for the business. They're going to go and do their due diligence, right? So they go, they do their due diligence. It could be legal diligence, accounting diligence, human capital management diligence, obviously near and dear to our hearts, right, James, especially yours, technology, cybersecurity diligence, operational, supply chain diligence. They're going to pick apart that company with a fine-tooth comb, really because they want to make sure they're making a sound investment decision. They want to know, are there skeletons in the closet, so on and so forth. So let's say that all checks out and they like it. They think they like the team and they close on the transaction, right? So they acquire the business. Now, interestingly, sometimes they're acquiring 100% of the business, but a lot of people don't realize that in many, many situations, they might not be acquiring 100% of the business. There may be the founder of the business who is rolling some of his equity into the deal, right? So maybe the founder, the entrepreneur owned 100% of it until the private equity firm comes along. Maybe the private equity firm buys 40, 60, 80%, could be minority, could be majority control, but they're buying a meaningful percentage of the ownership of the business. And deals come in many different shapes and sizes. We're not going to get into structuring here today. We don't have time for it. But I bring this up because it's not always them doing complete buyouts. Oftentimes there's, you know, other parties involved. But they'll go and they acquire the business. And then obviously they're going to hope that the company does well over the next 5 years, 7 years, whatever their ownership cycle is going to look like, and grows the revenue and profit grows and EBITDA grows. And it creates a nice investment outcome when they go and sell it for more money. Obviously, they're trying to do than they paid for it, right? Now, I used the word hope here a moment ago. Some private equity firms, their style is a little bit more make a good decision and hope it works out. But what's kind of played out over the last 25 or 30 years as this industry has evolved, and it's evolved quite profoundly, is that most private equity firms add what they call operational value. So it's not just going to be that they invested in the business like it is in the public markets where you kind of buy X percent of the company and hope the management team does a nice job. And if you happen to have a bunch of money and you've bought 10 or 20% of the business, maybe you could get a board seat. In most cases, in these private equity backed deals, they're buying a material stake in the business, 40, 80, 60, somewhere like that percent. And they have governance control. So they often have all or most of the board seats. So they're rather involved in the decision-making at the highest levels. They also have the responsibility of in almost every situation, choosing who the CEO is. And that could be whoever the current CEO is. It could continue to be the entrepreneur founder who started the business. But in many cases, they may be bringing in a new CEO or a new CFO or a new CEO and a new CFO. Every deal's a little bit different, but they're typically very involved in those decisions. And oftentimes, especially in larger businesses, they're going to be quite hands-on in helping to work with those management team members to try to develop strategies to grow the business and make sure the company has the resources it needs to be successful, and then implementing some of those strategies. And it's not to say most private equity firms, the professionals that run those firms, they're really not operators. They can be quite wise when it comes to structuring deals, finding good businesses to buy, raising the capital to do that, both the debt and the equity, getting those deals done, coming up with strategies, challenging strategies of the management team. And they're particularly good, many of them, at helping thinking through M&A strategies and executing M&A and trying to grow through acquisition. That's really a big, strong value add that they can bring to the table. But they typically don't have a tremendous amount of operational expertise. So there is this, if all goes to plan, there needs to be a really symbiotic relationship between the management team who's responsible for operating the business every day and the private equity investors who are responsible for making sure that their investment goes to plan, that they've got the right leadership team in place, the company has the right resources. And sometimes they'll bring some of those resources. Those resources may be in-house. Oftentimes those are called operating partners. In many instances, you're going to have a lot of consultants who come in. Not that bringing consultants in is necessarily a bad thing or represents that there's a deficiency in the business, James, but really it's maybe a company's trying to do something it's never done before. Open up on a new continent, a new manufacturing facility. Maybe they're trying to penetrate a new market that they've never done that before, or they've never been good at or really terribly structured about optimizing their pricing or optimizing their inventory management. Oftentimes you find businesses at different stages of their growth need different resources, right? And private equity firms are often very quick to bring in experts, consultants, new additions to the management team that are going to help that company grow and prosper. So I can talk about this all day. So you got to stop me if I'm going
to. Yeah. I think we've done a nice job, by we, I mean you, we've established what is a private equity firm. We went into how does it fundraise. We then talked about how does it find businesses. Really nice conversation right now on how does it deploy. You talked about it for a second, but maybe if we could just kind of close out. Let's finish the loop. You said 3 to 5 to 7 year hold for those firms. How does it exit? Now, I know we said where it exits, but how does it exit? Let's close it out on that. Yeah. And what are some of the implications? Because now they have these investments. Do I just cut a check back for what you invested? Or how does that kind of exit process work? And I guess one of the base questions is, why do folks invest in private equity? Mm-hmm. And why do businesses exit private equity firms? Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. These 10 investments, in the private equity world, we call them portfolio companies. It's a company that's in a portfolio of the fund, right? Portfolio company. You've bought it, you've improved it. Now it's time to exit it. How that happens, we on our channel here, we always use the selling house or flipping house analogy. Another really good opportunity to do that here. We probably should have called this the House Flippers podcast.
Yeah.
It's just a very convenient analogy. Not dissimilar from a house. There are agents in the M&A world, private equity community, we call them investment bankers. They kind of act like real estate agents. The process that they use is the investment bankers will come in. They may already be familiar with the business. Maybe they helped sell it to the current owners, the current private equity firm, but they're going to come in. They're going to look at all the financials. They typically are very sector focused, you know, especially the kind of more well-renowned ones. They tend to specialize in industrials or tech or B2B services. You know, they tend to have that type of expertise. So they're very familiar with the industry typically that you're, whatever industry that particular portfolio company may be involved with. So they'll come in, they know what's going on in the industry. They tend to know a lot of the buyers in that industry. So they kind of know what people are paying for businesses of certain sizes in certain sectors with certain characteristics. Characteristics could include gross margins that look like X versus Y, or if your CAGR is 3% versus 8%, they'll have a pretty fundamental understanding as to what type of premium you might command for the 7% CAGR business versus the 3%. You know, so they do bring quite a bit to the table, even in those preliminary discussions, but you'll typically approach 2, 3, 4, 5 would probably be a large number of bankers that have the relevant sector expertise. And you'll say, hey, we're thinking about selling this business. Obviously, this is all done very confidentially. We're thinking about selling this business. Come and take a look. Give us some thoughts on where the market is. Do you think this is a good time to sell? And if the parties agree, yes, it's a good time to sell. The owners of the business, in this case, the private equity firm, they'll work with the CEO to help choose which banker they think would be best to represent them in a sale process. They may do some sell side due diligence. We've talked about that briefly on other episodes, but sell side due diligence is really a company that's selling themselves. They're going to hire some experts to come in and write some fancy reports. I'm not trying to belittle them, but this isn't a sell side due diligence podcast episode, so we're going to cover it briefly. They're going to create some fancy reports that kind of help prop up the business and why it's a good company to buy. And they may do things like look at the technology stack in the business. Does the company have the appropriate cybersecurity protocols that a company this size should? And you might go, well, why would somebody selling that want to talk about their cybersecurity protocols and advertise that to the next buyer? Well, the reality is, if you can de-risk the deal for the next buyer, in this case, if you can convince the buyer that, hey, listen, we know cybersecurity is important to most investors out there. We do a really great job, as attested to by this world-renowned third-party consulting firm or advisor. It gives those buyers a lot of comfort that, hey, we're probably going to check this out when we do our own diligence, but it gives them comfort that what they're looking at is as exciting as they hope it is. Keeps them a little bit more engaged in the process. So you may do some sell-side due diligence, but then that investment banker is going to help, again, on a very confidential and limited basis, go out to the buyer universe that they typically have strong relationships with. That's what those guys do for a living. They're going to go out to that buyer universe and articulate the great things about this business and try and convince people that buy businesses for a living. So that oftentimes means other private equity firms, but it also could mean large corporations or maybe some large families who acquire large businesses. Try and get them excited about looking at the business and hopefully convince one or two of them to put in bids and hopefully sell the business for a nice profit.
Yeah, interesting. And then the beauty of that is that that goes back to the folks that invested, and it's a nice symbiotic circle there. Mm-hmm. I thought, Mike, we kind of had like a really good chat where we crammed in a lot on the 101 to try to talk about these topics. I thought we'd end on maybe a little bit of a lighter note, if you're okay with some quick hits.
Go for it.
So I'm going to read you some sentiments around private equity based on organizations going bankrupt and the sensational headlines that were created from those organizations going mm-hmm. bankrupt.
Okay? Go for it.
So the idea is misconceptions.
Got it.
Quick hit.
You're assuming I've read those headlines. We'll see.
We'll see. You're a studied man. First quick hit. Private equity only focuses on cutting costs.
Yes. So the media loves to talk about how bad private equity is because all they do is slash and burn to line their pockets. I'm sure there are a handful of firms out there whose culture it is and their business strategy is and their investment thesis is, let's cut every cost we possibly can to line our pockets as quickly as we possibly can. I've worked with 500 or more different private equity firms. There's about, depends on who you ask, but there's probably about 5,000 or so private equity firms out there. So I've worked with a reasonable chunk of those over the last couple of decades. I haven't really found any of those yet, you know, at least not at the firm level. You know, there may be some individuals at some of those firms who would be maybe bad actors, as the media would like to describe them, but couldn't be further from the truth, in my experience at least. And I think, you know, most of the folks in the industry would attest to this. The reality is that you can't really get where you're trying to go in private equity if all you do is cut costs. If you come into a business, let's use this $100 million industrial manufacturing business as an example. If you've bought it not in a turnaround situation, right? And there are certainly going to be some situations where businesses are either in bankruptcy or close to being in bankruptcy or just coming out of bankruptcy. And there's a lot of tough decisions that need to get made because you got to take cost out to save the enterprise. That is not most private equity deals. Most private equity firms, their strategy involves buying, generally speaking, fairly healthy companies and helping them to become even more healthy companies. And really their incentive is to grow them, right? To grow their earnings. This isn't the turnaround industry, right? This is the private equity industry. And a subset of that is involved in fixing broken companies, but the vast majority of these dollars are going into the guy who down the street from you, he started a company when he was 31 because he's had an idea about how to make some kind of product better or how to deliver a service better, or somebody who started one franchise and went on to grow it to 20 different franchise units in a particular geography, it now does 5 or 10 or 20 million or 30, 40 million of EBITDA, very profitable business. Those people need liquidity. Liquidity doesn't exist anymore in the IPO market like it used to 30, 40 years ago. In fact, there's been a material decline in the number of companies that are able to go public. You know, to be a publicly traded company these days, below about $1 billion or $2 billion in revenue, it just doesn't make sense with all the compliance regulations. So really, there aren't that many other people out there who you can sell a business when that owner goes to sell outside of private equity. And private equity firms, if they come and buy a business that's doing, let's just say, 10 million of EBITDA and 100 million in sales, the only way that they're going to make a great investment return is if they grow sales and grow earnings, right? It's not a sales stay flat and earnings double. If it was that easy, it'd be easy to make every executive on earth, if it was that easy, would be making their bonuses this year, because they'd be all cutting costs in order to get to that place. And even if they were successful doing it this year, good luck trying to repeat the same performance next year, right? So you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot from a long-term strategy perspective. So really, could be further from the truth. My experience is this, James. I've seen family-run businesses, a lot of them. I've seen a lot of private equity-owned businesses, and I've seen a lot of publicly traded businesses. And my assessment is this. Family-owned businesses tend to manage those businesses to, and many of them want to grow, but many of them also want to maximize cash flow in the year. The reason being that cash flow that those businesses generate for those families funds the lifestyles of those families. And when you start earning $3 or $4 or $5 or $10 or $20 million a year as a family-owned business, you get used to having that type of significant discretionary income. And when you have to go and grow that business, if that means going and setting up a new factory and that's going to cost $20 million in new equipment, you have to make the tough decision of, instead of making $20 million that year, I'm going to make $0 that year. Because hopefully, 5 years from now, when that factory is at full production, I'll be making $30 million instead of the $20 I used to make. That's a very large risk for a family to take on, right? A very large risk. And that's just one example. There could be many others. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, you have publicly traded businesses. It's widely known, pick up any newspaper, and media is going to give those guys a hard time about this too. It's widely known that most publicly traded businesses have to manage to the quarter. Because if they don't manage to the quarter, the street gets upset, the stock price goes down, all the executives don't hit their bonuses, their stock options aren't worth anything. So the executives in those businesses who are running those companies every day are highly incentivized to keep the stock price as high as possible. How do you do that? You always deliver on your numbers quarter in and quarter out. You're managing to the quarter. So family businesses, they're kind of managing to the year. Publicly traded businesses managing to the quarter, that's even shorter term thinking. In every private equity investment that I've ever made, I think I've made now 40 or so private equity investments. In every one of those, and in almost every private equity backed business that I've ever consulted to, every single one of those businesses has a 5-year plus investment horizon. They have a 5-year strategic plan. They're making those $20 million investments in that new factory because they're like, listen, the only way that I can achieve my investment objectives 5 or 7 years from now, which is typically their target hold period, is if I build this factory. Therefore, I would argue that private equity owned businesses or private equity backed businesses tend to receive a significantly higher level of reinvestment back in the business to fund growth. And it, you know, there couldn't be anything more opposite than cutting costs than reinvesting tons of money back in the business so it can grow. Again, I'm sure somebody will have examples that they'd love to use to prove me wrong, but that's just been my experience.
Yeah. Well, and that's the point of this. So my inspiration for PE only folks cutting costs is Toys R Us. Mm-hmm. The trivia for today, and I'm making it easy on you. Mm-hmm. Only in the last 10 years is this answer. In what year, or in which year, we'll have a someone who's better at English than myself tell me, did Toys R Us go bankrupt in the last 10?
I feel like Toys R Us might have gone bankrupt twice. I might be wrong. I don't know. It's got to be post financial crisis. I'm going to guess 2012.
Ooh, pretty close. 2017.
Okay.
You know, the interesting thing about 2017 is neither of our children will have ever experienced the opportunity of walking through a Toys R Us, the free Disneyland, and experiencing all that was Toys R Us.
Well, to be honest, with as many Amazon packages as my house receives every day, I'm not sure that even if they had managed their balance sheet a little better during those tough times, I'm not sure my kids ever would have seen the inside of a Toys R Us anyway.
Fair point.
Yeah.
Okay. You ready for the next one?
I'm ready. Shoot.
Private equity only focuses on short-term profit and they're short-term profit seekers.
Yeah. I mean, like I was talking about, you know, I couldn't be further from the truth in my experience. I haven't talked that much about debt yet either, but the thing about most private equity investments, not all, certainly not all, but I think it's fair to say most are going to involve a reasonable amount of debt. Some might argue unreasonable amount of debt. And certainly some deals get done with probably too much debt. Usually that is realized in hindsight. These private equity investors are pretty smart guys and gals. They're not intentionally putting too much debt on businesses' balance sheet, despite what the media, I think, would love to have the population believe. But they really can't be short-term profit seekers. When you invest in a private equity fund, and the investors know this, you know, like I mentioned earlier, it's a 10-year fund life cycle. So you're investing in a fund today, hoping that by 10 years from now, you're going to get an acceptable level of return on your investment. 10 years is a really long time. I mean, it's obviously not 20 or 30 years. That'd be even longer, but 10 years is a pretty long time. So the investors in the underlying fund have a long-term mindset. The manager of that fund, who set up the fund in the first place as a 10-year fund, has a long-term mindset. Their target hold period is, you know, 5 to 7 years. That is at a minimum, a medium-term mindset. But when they go to sell that business, if they're going to sell it for a really nice number, it has to be a growing business that looks attractive to the next buyer who is going to want to grow that business, right? So I think private equity gets a little bit of a bad rap because, you know, some people might want to argue, or maybe it's easy for the media to argue, like, well, if you're only going to own a business for 3 or 4 or 5 years, like, you can't be thinking long-term. And I would argue, you know, hey, let's give them a little bit of credit for the fact that, you know, they can't do what they're setting out and intending to do unless they're preparing the business for future long-term ownership, even if they don't happen to be the owners of that particular asset, you know, beyond their hold period. So, you know, this right here is something I'm sure the pundits could talk about for, you know, days on end. And, you know, you're going to have a lot of differences of opinion, but, you know, I've been in this industry for a couple of years now, at least, you know, those are my opinions.
I like them. Stand by them. So my inspiration for short-term profit seekers was Sears. So, you know, going back to it, it's kind of interesting. Young James went to Sears a lot. My grandfather said, if it didn't come from Sears, it wasn't worth it. Craftsman tool guy, loved it.
Don't you still shop at Sears? Isn't that where you got that, that outfit you're wearing?
Yeah, that was actually JCPenney, Mike.
Okay.
But the Sears side of it was a popular thing in the Bandy household. And so I was a little sad. Maybe let me rephrase that. In which year was I sad that Sears went bankrupt?
I didn't realize I needed to take a retail history lesson here before today's cast.
Got to step your game up.
In what year did Sears go bankrupt? I don't know. I'm going to probably have the same answer. I feel like I went into a Sears at one point post global financial crisis, and there wasn't much on the shelves. 2013.
Okay. Unfortunately, it was the domino after Toys R Us in 2018. It's an interesting childhood domino effect. I would also like to ask you, not accusatory, but just a question. Did you look at my show prep sheet before the cast today?
I did not.
Your crystal ball is really coming into play. Because my next one is private equity always saddles their target with debt and the deals are always highly leveraged.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, not every deal has debt, but oftentimes it's a tool that private equity firms use to improve their returns. You know, going into that in detail is an episode in and of itself. But you know, listen, there's always going to be examples of businesses that had too much debt put on their balance sheet, whether it was from their original acquisition or some other add-on acquisition that they did, or they funded new equipment purchases, whatever the case may be. There's always going to be businesses that get over leveraged with debt, get too far out over their skis, and have issues. The reality of the situation, though, and what I always like to encourage people to do is look at their personal investment portfolios. Go pull the reports, the 10-Ks from some of the businesses that you have in your 401k or your brokerage portfolio. Go look at those companies' balance sheets. There are very few publicly traded businesses that don't have a lot of debt on their balance sheets. In fact, one of the primary reasons to go public in the first place for most companies is to access the debt capital markets more efficiently and at better pricing than you can in the private capital markets. And I venture to guess that if you compared the average amount of debt of publicly traded businesses on their balance sheet to the amount of debt on private equity backed businesses' balance sheets, that private equity would actually have less debt on a relative basis. So again, you know, media loves to talk these things up, you know, actual reality, what we're living in and seeing as we're inside these businesses every day, a little bit different from what you're reading on the front page of the journal at the time sometimes.
Interesting. And it's an interesting point. So I always kind of have these moments where I kind of learn things by accident, let's call it. So I was working at a company, $19 billion company. We go in and we acquire a $40 billion organization. I'm not the best at math, but it was double the annual revenue. And the way that my life works is it usually I have to make more than the number I want to spend to be able to get there. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time I ever learned that these groups leverage debt. Mm-hmm. The second time I learned that these groups leverage debt is about 30 days after close when I got my new P&L and I got my new pressure. And because the new kid in town, everything got cut from my budget. So it was a good lesson. And I think that's an important one for folks that maybe haven't had that experience or done the research that you do. Mm-hmm. It does happen. So let me tell you the one I have for this one. And I think this will shock people. I don't think a lot of people know that these guys went through a bankruptcy. Caesars Entertainment. So, do you gamble at all?
No, thankfully.
Okay, great. Well, good thing you didn't gamble on Caesars, because in which year did Caesars go bankrupt?
Jeez, you're pulling out all these retail businesses.
Caesars isn't retail. Caesars is an entertainment brand, yeah, friend.
I don't work much in entertainment.
And if you ask Zach Galifianakis, it's where the real Caesar lives. So it's his house.
By the way, if you start asking me names of celebrities and expect, I know he's a celebrity, but if you expect that I know who that is, I mean, you just couldn't be further from wrong. I don't do celebrities. I don't know who anybody
is. Movies?
Movies. I watch movies.
Okay, let's try to get there. He wore a baby on the front of him.
Oh, okay. Hangover.
Hangover. There correct. You go. He, I believe, was quoted to say, "Does the real Caesar live here?" It's that gentleman.
Oh, I know who that guy is now.
Okay, great.
Okay.
So in which year would Zach be sad that the real Caesar got kicked out of his house because that organization went bankrupt?
Caesars went down?
Yeah.
Learn something new every day. Mm-hmm. Won't catch me in Vegas unless I have to go there for a conference.
Yeah, agreed.
I have no idea.
2015.
News to me.
Yep. And we're going to round it out with another retail brand just to give you the heads up and warning before we get there.
Make this stop.
Well, hold on. One of us comes from retail and didn't have the private equity background. The other has the private equity background. Yeah, fair. It's a chance for the retail guy to get fair. A swing at it. The last one. I think this one's interesting because I honestly had this opinion before coming in and learning from you and others about private equity. They only buy struggling companies.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We hear that a lot. Common misconception. Even if you have a broad definition of struggling, again, it wouldn't really be true, right? Like I was talking about earlier about, you know, turnarounds. Certainly, you know, companies that are having a bad day sometimes come up for sale. And there are certain types of private equity investors who like doing those kinds of investments, you know, who are good at stepping into a situation where maybe some tough decisions need to get made, or maybe they just lost their largest customer and they're trying to figure out what to do about that situation, or businesses that have some type of supply chain constraint that was unexpected and catastrophic, or whatever the case may be, right? But again, it depends on what you mean by struggling. You know, I would say there's a couple different types of firms. There are firms that like to get their hands really dirty, you know, really deep turnarounds. Those obviously would be struggling companies. And there are, you know, a number of firms, private equity firms that specialize in that. Not as many as, you know, as you might think, though. It's a fairly small subsector of the industry. You know, the next group of companies, and there's a lot of these companies, and as a result, there's a lot of these kinds of private equity firms, are companies that aren't necessarily having a bad day, but also aren't having their greatest day. And probably a better way of explaining that would be, you know, sometimes businesses go through seasons, is how I like to think about it. You know, maybe you are a founder, entrepreneur owned business, and the entrepreneur started the business in his or her 40s. And that was 45 years ago. And now that owner is 85. And maybe they have no family members that were involved in the business, or maybe no family members want to be involved in the business. And they've got 10 grandkids that they want to spend a lot of time with. And for the last 15 years, that's been their priority as they've gotten on in life. But they still own and maybe still operate the business themselves. Maybe they have a leadership team. But maybe as a result of some of the things that we talked about earlier as well, where, you know, they've used the cash flow that the business generates to fund their lifestyle. And this is not every example, it's just one example. They've to fund that lifestyle of spending more time with their grandkids. You know, maybe you have a situation where they haven't been investing back in the business as vigorously as they might have when they were in startup mode some 40 plus years prior. Maybe they're not introducing as many new products. Maybe they're not exploring new customers because they're happy with the ones that they have. Maybe they're not great at implementing the latest and greatest ERP system or solution, or, you know, they're not able to leverage automation or don't want to fund automation that would unlock, you know, growth opportunities for the business. So, you know, is that business having a bad day? Listen, we see businesses all the time doing 10, 20, 30% EBITDA margins on a couple hundred million dollars in sales that fit that exact scenario that I just described. Are they doing anything wrong? No. Are they struggling? Absolutely not. In fact, highly profitable enterprises creating really nice lifestyles. But is there room for opportunity for improvement? Absolutely. You know, we always go back to the great Jim Collins book of Good to Great, right? And what we tell a lot of our clients, you know, our consulting clients over the years, was we like to take good companies and help them become great companies. And I think that's a really good example of just that, right? You can have a good little company that maybe isn't a great company yet. And I think that really is, you know, private equity, this isn't my thinking, this is the private equity industry at large. Many, 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 definitely most private equity firms are out there hungry looking for those types of opportunities, where they can step in and buy a pretty good business with a pretty good team and help make it a great business. And maybe that team becomes the great team. They just needed more resources. Or maybe in other instances, you need to, you know, upgrade the team. Every situation is a little bit different. But, you know, the notion that private equity only buys struggling companies couldn't be further from the truth. You know, private equity investors love to buy good companies, make them great. They also like buying great companies and keeping them great. It's actually I venture to guess there'd be a lot of consensus if you polled a bunch of private equity firms. Would you rather buy a good company, make it great, or a great company and have it continue to be great? And they'd probably be happy with both.
Interesting. I know you're a little fatigued on the guessing, and I know this one's near and dear to your heart because you used to be a model for these guys. J. Crew.
Oh, yeah.
In 2020.
Yeah. Yeah, I probably modeled for them for a long time. I just can't remember the years. J. Crew went under in 2020?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, if I was a retail-focused guy, I spend most of my time in industrials. You know, I might know some of these dates, but
hey,
are they still around? J. Crew still around?
No.
My kids have stuff.
I don't know. I know you know Jorts, but you may not know J. Crew. Well, I wanted to thank you for your time. Sorry I went a little retail-y at the end there, but I think it's a good education for our listeners to understand private equity, a bit of a 101 course. I think there's a couple interviews maybe that we can do after this and a couple more deep dives.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Growing EBITDA. If you like this episode, hit subscribe or follow us on LinkedIn for updates. Got a topic you'd like us to cover? Drop us a message. We'd love to hear from you.